The BASTEM Global Competitiveness Conference presents Leadership and Excellence in Diversity, Sustaining the Diversity Momentum in Changing Times, a professional development seminar featuring Senior Vice President of the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, Donnie Harper, Manager for Diversity and Inclusion for Missile Systems for Raytheon, Lisa Reiser, Director of Diversity and Inclusion for Lockheed Martin, Cheryl Kern, and CEO of Farrer Sirmani Group, Dr. Janice Farrer Sirmani. What does it mean to be a diversity leader? Over the past several years, diversity has been a hot topic. However, as times change and business challenges increase, the term has become a stale reference to check off a list of politically correct requirements. As leaders in diversity, we are challenged to educate, energize, and excite our organization around diversity initiatives. These initiatives build the foundation of creativity, innovation, and transformative results. Diversity and inclusion leaders are key players on the executive leadership team with the specific responsibility for ensuring that human resources are honored, embraced, and ready to contribute great value. Diversity and inclusion leaders are trusted advisors that fundamentally create strategies that result in corporate cultural transformations to effectively support the mission and vision of the organization. To continue to be successful and safeguard the great work and efforts of those before you, you must create a brand and image that reflects high integrity and strong leadership capacity. This workshop will arm you with the skills you need to change your leadership image and effectively function as a vital part of the leadership vision. Without further ado, the BASTEM Global Competitiveness Conference presents Leadership and Excellence in Diversity, Sustaining the Diversity Momentum in Changing Times, featuring Donnie Harper, Lisa Reiser, Cheryl Kern, and Dr. Janice Farrer Sirmani.
All right, well, good morning again. How's everyone doing? All right, good. So this is going to be a really great session. We're here to talk about what? Leadership and excellence in diversity, changing times. So we've got a jam-packed session here for you. I'm privileged to here work with an esteemed panel of experts here in the diversity field. We'll go through some introductions here in just a moment. I have a few housekeeping items I have to do at the very beginning of these sessions. So you know the session that you're in here in the Virginia Room. Also, we encourage you to participate throughout the entire sessions. We'll give you opportunities to ask questions along as we go along the way. Also, if you need PDU credits as well as CEU credits, be sure to stop by the Morgan State table out front to get those registered. And then also, you have a survey in your seat, and we would kindly ask that you complete that survey at the end of the session to give us some feedback on how we can improve these sessions going forward. So, with no further introduction, I've already asked how many first-timers are here and how many repeat people, but we want to really see the composition of the audience so that we can tailor our discussion to what you want to hear most. So how many of you are possibly high schoolers? All right, no high schoolers. How many are undergraduate students? All right, so they're all sitting on the right-hand side of the building. All right, fine.
In the back.
Graduate students. Anybody in grad school? All right. So how about early career? I define early career from 0 to 2 years of experience. 0 to 2 years of experience. Uh-oh, mid-career. All right, mid-career. How about seniors, elders? Yeah, there you go.
Hey,
everybody, I just see what happened behind me. What did they do? All right, fantastic. All right, so the reason we asked this question is really, we want to make sure that we want to tailor the conversation consistent with what you really want to hear. And our objectives for today. So some of you certainly read in your syllabus the reasons that you're here. You saw the objectives in terms of what we're going to be talking about relative to diversity. And I will tell you up front that one of the things that we're going to try to do is we're going to give you a tool and a capability to help you with understanding and navigating diversity in changing times. All right. So we can stand here today and talk about all the ills of the country, all the ills of organizations, all the ills of trying to work against bias and things of that nature. But we're going to also talk about tools and capabilities, how you can think about diversity going forward and how that can aid you going forward. So we're going to try to give you some really practical capabilities and processes that you can take out of here. So you can see all of the objectives that we have outlined here, but I have another poll and survey question that we want to do up front before we go through our introduction. So we don't have the mic there, but I'm going to steal the mic back up here. And anybody that would like to maybe tell us, if you don't hear anything today, what is the one thing that you want to hear before you leave here today relative to diversity and changing times? Anybody want to volunteer to go first?
Hi, my name is Salome Denke. I'm a student at the University of Houston. The reason I came to this session was I wanted to hear more about how to retain blacks in the corporate America culture that's going on right now.
All right, so how to retain.
How to retain.
How about also to attract or retain only?
More retention. Because from what I've seen, like during my co-ops and internships, there were a lot of blacks that would come, but they wouldn't stay. And they would leave and move to different areas where they could feel more comfortable. And I want to see how we can retain them so that way we can see the difference among corporate America.
Wonderful, wonderful. I saw a question right here. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Hi, okay, my name is Lacey. I'm from the University of Michigan. So my question is about diversity and like being comfortable in spaces where you might be the only person of color or the only woman in the room.
Okay, very good. So we've heard from two early career. How about any seasoned professionals or mid-career? Maybe one more question. I have to go to this side of the room, sounds like. Okay, sure.
All right, I'm Teresa Sproul. I'm with AT&T, and I actually am in diversity and inclusion. And I'm here to, it would be helpful if this team would give us some tools or some takeaways to focus on how we make, I know this is momentum here, but how do we remain relevant in keeping this particular segment in the forefront? Because we're seeing in these changing times that while the numbers seem to look like there's movement, we still need to move the needle.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Fair enough?
Very good. Thank you. Well, thank you all. And certainly, we will give you opportunities to ask more questions as we go along the way. But let me first start with some introductions. And unfortunately, I have to go first. I always believe I'm a, you know, you don't even know the story yet, okay?
You're already
laughing. All right, so we want to do some fun facts because we're all human. So as you know, as almost part of the last questions about, we're all individuals and we're all encouraged to bring our whole selves to work. I'm sure you probably hear that in your organization relative to diversity and inclusion. So we want to tell kind of let you know that we have a life outside of work too, and that affects certainly who we are and how we show up and how we interact with all of our colleagues at work. So I have to go first. So Donnie Harper, Federal Reserve, worked with the organization for 30 years, really a career IT guy. I've worked in IT for 28 years, only the last 2 years in diversity and inclusion and in the HR area, running our HR. And the reason I moved over to HR is because I really like people. I can think about all the things that we built relative to IT systems in the Federal Reserve System, which we can take a lot of pride in, but the only legacy a person can leave is going to be the people behind you. So that's why I moved over to HR to try to make a difference relative to retention, and that is how can we retain more and more minorities in our organization as we go forward. So that's why I moved over to HR. So my fun fact there is I do a lot of competitive bass fishing. Not as much as I want to. I'm going to do even more after September because I retire in September of this year.
Oh, all right.
Round of applause. Okay. No. It's not about me. It's about the fishing. Okay. All right. So and certainly look at that picture there. You see a big mouth and a big stomach. I'm talking about the fish. All right. Okay. All right. So okay. But that's what I'm going to be doing after my retirement. So. With no further ado, I'll ask one more thing. I'm not going to do this, but I'm going to ask my panelists to do this as they introduce themselves to talk about diversity and inclusion in 60 seconds and what it means to them in terms of sustaining their momentum in changing times. So with no further ado, we're going to go first to Lisa. Lisa?
Actually, I go first. Okay. Yeah. Thank you, Donnie. Hi, it's a pleasure to meet you all. It's a pleasure to be here at BEA. This is my second BEA. Loving it. This is my favorite conference, and I'm not just saying that. It's a very dynamic conference. I am the manager for diversity and inclusion at Missile Systems. So Raytheon, we have 5 business units. Missile Systems is based out of Tucson, Arizona. That's one of our 5. And I have actually the fun job of deploying what is our corporate diversity and inclusion strategy. So I get to do all the creative design of what does that strategy really mean? I mean, how do we really deploy that? How do we, and to answer some of your questions, how do we retain that top talent of color? How do we make them feel like they are included and their voices are heard? So for me, that's a fun job, right? That's something I love. I was asked to share a little bit about myself. My background is multilingual, multicultural. I speak a variety of languages, including engineering sometimes. I've learned. And I was an expat for 20 years. So a lot of that kind of informs my own ability to work in industry. I have an MBA, so I'm very business minded. But on a personal level, I'm an artist. I've been an artist my whole life. And I really shied away from it in college because my mother, my father, everyone told me, don't waste, you know, college is expensive, it's really hard to go through, I'm still paying. You know, don't waste it on a degree in art. Get something that will get you a real job. Well, when the time came for me to step out of corporate America for 9 years to take care of family, I fell back on that passion. And I would run art galleries, art auctions, I sold paintings. Didn't make a lot of money, but it kept me going. The interesting fact is that is now something that I bring to my day job. So as we progress with the panel, I want to talk to you more about that whole concept of bring your whole self to work. What does that really look like? What do they mean when they say, let's bring our whole selves to work? Because it's about tapping into those passions you have and transferring those skills into marketable skills, and then how do you bring that into the office place in a way that no one else is doing? So, that's me.
Wonderful. Cheryl.
And I'm Cheryl Kern, nice to be with everyone today. I'm a director of diversity and inclusion, so same line of work as Lisa, different company, best company in the world, Lockheed Martin. You know, in the work that I have the good fortune of being involved in on a daily basis, and it definitely is a team effort, but I have direct responsibility for what we call our employee resource group. So I think most of you know what that term means. Also the opportunity to help to lead a lot of the development of the training and the education that the company is committed to for making sure that we can continue to be a leader in this area. And I'll talk about some of that a little bit later when we talk about what the future of D&I really looks like and what we need to focus on. And then also, very similar to Lisa, lead the efforts to actually develop and to deploy the strategy for global diversity and inclusion on our team. I love BEA as well. This is my second time at BEA as well. Last week when I had a big event, I thought I had the coolest job in the company. Now I'm at BEA. I think Scott Trapp has the coolest job in the company. And so we do lots of fun things in D&I, and we have a really, really great leadership team and leader. It was easy when he asked me about my fun fact because I love spas. And it was like I already had pictures ready, and I was like, oh, this will take me 3 minutes because I've gone to spas. I don't see my spas up there that I sent in, but that's okay. But I've gone to spas in Paris, in Shanghai. In Shanghai, where two women walked on my back. I've never had a spa like that before. They actually did a spa that way. In South America. And so I really, truly love to adventure out and to experience different spas. So really glad to be with you all today.
Wonderful. All right. And finally, last but not least, our presenter, Janice.
Hi, I'm Janice Farrar-Samani, and I'll start with my fun fact. My fun fact is last year I was very, very fortunate to have traveled numerous continents, as I shared with you here, 4 continents and 6 regions, inclusive of about 15 countries. So I had an incredible year, 2018, looking forward to the future of 2019. My background is very different from the rest of the panel. I'm an economist by my undergraduate. My graduate is MBA, as well as an MBA in civil engineering, urban planning, and I have a PhD in business. My second doctorate actually is in data analytics. So currently, I am a data analytic CEO and founder. I have a STEM program that actually reaches out to young career individuals as well as high school students, and we're just expanding, so it's quite exciting. I travel the world and I work with women and youth on STEM and get them engaged and excited about engineering and technology and advancement in those areas. And so that's what I'll be bringing to the table, the entrepreneurial spirit, if you will, and making it relevant, keeping D&I in the forefront and that intersection, which is so critical and vital to stimulating technology. And I'm from Silicon Valley, so I have a completely different spin on D&I, and in particular, diversity and inclusion. So I'd like to also say good morning to you. This, I believe, is my fourth BEA. So thank you to the BEA conference team for the pleasure of being part of this distinguished panel. It's quite an honor to be here and to talk about leadership excellence in diversity, sustaining diversity momentum in these changing times. As I shared with you, being from Silicon Valley, it's a very rapidly changing industries out there. Before you know it, there's pop-ups everywhere, there's accelerators, there's incubators, and there's an incredible amount of movement and change within industry. So in my early stages of my professional career, I actually was a regional information mobility engineer. I actually was in charge, I had the daunting charge of converting landlines into personal communication systems, what are now cell phones. So how many of you, and some of you have shared being the only one in your program or in your company, how many of you are the only person of color or female or black individual in your company? How many of you were the only one in your department or in your program in school? Most of us. So it's not an anomaly. Actually, I was the only one, or it is, it's very interesting. I was the only black person in the company starting out my career. It was not a unique experience. I was one of two in my graduate program. And so I really support the historically black colleges as the key intersection to America's future. Currently, as a professor at Santa Clara University and a developer of the practicum program for engineering in the Graduate School of Information Networking at Carnegie Mellon University. And I'm also working as the founder and CEO in these roles of business intelligence and data analytics. I have found that it is critical to have a vision, if you will, and to refine that vision of diversity and inclusion with the goal of achieving sustainable and diverse organizations. The key there is the adaptation, so we can rapidly change in these times. I saw the need to actually develop a system or a tool that would help to advance the initiatives and some of the innovations that my organization in particular was undergoing. But I also saw this as being very critical in Silicon Valley because of the rapid change. Every 3 months, a new product is out, or a new process, or a new system. So this mobility matrix is an actual tool that intersects the objectives of individuals, teams, and organizations. The outcome actually transforms the work environment where the talents and the abilities are recognized. The values are integrated, the creativity to innovate are identified, and the continuation of the team members and staff as far as coming together and actually collaborating to engage on this processes is actually quite successful. So here we have the mobility matrix. It's actually a power tool, I call it, a powerful tool that actually determines how to accomplish and sustain your as well as your organization diversity goals. This matrix actually identifies the strategies and it advocates openly the coordination of the ecosystem for momentum. I'd like to explain a bit about the matrix so we can utilize it as we continue our discussion. The diversity and inclusion components of this basically are three horizontal pillars. These pillars that are sustainable are creating value, creativity, as well as connectivity and community. The goal of the innovation, which is actually on the vertical axes, actually generates the idea of and brings together, highlighting the actual goals that you want to achieve. And then the intersection, those nodes, are actually the areas where you have the intersection of the objective as well as in alignment with the organization's values. So Donnie is going to actually bring into perspective some of the challenges and some of the opportunities that you have highlighted. I like to call them opportunities that you've highlighted in the beginning of this talk. So the panel will actually talk about those and develop our matrix, and then I'll come back and give you a model that you can actually implement.
Okay, great. Thanks, Janice. Fantastic. So maybe we can put into practical sense and practical terms the model and talk about how we go forward. So I think our last question that was asked is, how do we maintain and sustain a very diverse workforce going forward in the future? All right, so this is with the presumption, of course, that we have the ability and the capability within our organizations to attract and retain the right talent. We know how to find that particular skill set. All right, so I'll just kind of speak maybe what we're doing here at the Federal Reserve, and then I'll turn to the panelists also. They can offer a lot of great insight and wisdom too. So at the Federal Reserve System, you know, Denise has a PhD in economics. We are PhD economics, okay? That's what we do. We set monetary policy. We protect your money, all right? So that's what we do at the Federal Reserve. There are only 12 African-American PhD economists graduate each year, all right? Only 12 in the country, all right? And what do you think the likelihood is that we have the ability to hire those individuals? When you've got JP Morgan Chase, you've got companies out there that are willing to spend 3 and 4 times more than what we're willing to afford in order to hire them. So the likelihood is slim, all right? So we have to think about, what is our value proposition? What is it that we can do uniquely when we have to compete for talent? Because there is truly a war on talent. And what do we have to do and what can we do? So we talk about a lot of different things. We talk about the value of the experience. We talk about our benefit system. So we try to accentuate all the other aspects and talk about the actual growth that you can have within our organization. Because sometimes that can overcome the challenges that you might experience when you try to compete with somebody on a monetary standpoint. So for us, we realize that for us as a Federal Reserve System, we're not government, we're quasi-government, but for us, we have some of those same challenges other governmental entities may face relative to competition for talent, and we have to do some things far more unique than what we've ever had to do before, and really try to highlight those experiences and those learning capabilities and our 401k retirement plan as being great benefits as to why you might need to consider us. But let me kind of turn to also to Lisa, Cheryl, also any other perspectives in terms of what we do at Lockheed and Raytheon?
Yeah, so I don't mind chiming in first. The fact that we're at BEA is very timely. Because next week we'll also be at Lockheed Martin hosting over 350 of our African American talent that will come together for our annual forum with our African American Council that's focused on excellence. And so while Donnie was talking and while Janice was talking, it was a reminder to me about the focus that we now have on the full talent life cycle of our employees. And so when you think about what's going to be necessary to be successful in the future from a D&I standpoint, it really is understanding that whole person through every single stage of that life cycle, right? And so from when we start to promote, you know, such as we did when we came to BEA today, we pre-promoted, and hopefully we will recruit a lot of people. We've been very successful because of our promotion and because of how we show up with recruiting people in record numbers and offering same-day offers and a high acceptance rate. And as you move through that life cycle and then we bring people into the company, we are in the process now of actually shoring up many of our mentoring offerings with a goal of taking them full enterprise-wide. And I know the question was asked around retention, and maybe we'll get into that a little bit deeper later. But the one thing that I wanted to mention around retention, and I think we all are coming to understand this as leaders in this new future of work, which I don't know why we call it the future of work, because it's really now. But when you think about it within the context of the term, the future of work, is that we have to have this always on continual listening mode and stay as close as we can to our talent. And if you think about it, that is not an easy task, especially when we think about diversity of approach and style and thought. How do you do that? But it's really necessary. And I think technology, while it is our friend, and I am all in support of it, Janice, technology also can get in the way sometimes of staying close and having that continual listening opportunity. And technology can actually also be a barrier, just to give kind of a counterpoint in terms of something that's not as beneficial. And if you go all the way to the end of the life cycle, then what are you doing to actually make sure that, to your point, you don't have a shortage of people that are ready to go into some of those most coveted roles, and that you're working very closely with your talent management and your talent development organization to make sure that you're preparing those successors that will move into those roles. And so we're not yet calling it the talent life cycle, but when you step back, it's really what we're focusing on more and more to make sure that we can be as competitive as we can for our talent.
I'm more comfortable talking about the retention portion, since there were also a number of questions regarding retention, and that's really the core of my role. Something happens I think everyone in this room has heard of bias, right? There's a lot of talk about bias, even those of you in college right now, and in industry as well, and in the military. We're all doing a lot of bias training. But even that, how do you break that down? What does that really mean to be aware of our biases? And how, as a business, how can human resources really address bias in a way that enables people to bring their whole selves to work, to be respected as professionals, and to succeed? So there's particularly two very insidious forms of bias that we observe in industry and even in the military that is directly related to persons of color and to women. So the first one is called prove it again bias. And it is exactly how it sounds. And some of you will relate to this. I know I've related to this throughout my career, where you feel like every day you're proving yourself again. Right? Okay, I've done this, I passed the interview, you've seen my qualifications, you know I can handle this project, but somehow, again, I feel like I have to keep proving myself, right? The other form of very insidious bias, it's very particular to persons of color and to women, is called tightrope bias. And that's where we feel like we have to walk a tightrope. We can't get too passionate, too assertive, too happy, too not happy, because somehow there's all these labels associated with that, right? So at Raytheon, what we have done, and this is across corporate, but we've really looked at what are these particular paths that leaders have grown up in. We've developed leadership development training for anti-bias or, unconscious bias awareness, all different levels, but really looking at how that plays in ways at work that might not be readily visible. In concert with that, we have also implemented changes to our performance process so that we're very clear. When we are conducting, as leaders, performance reviews, we need to separate skill sets from personality, right? How many of us have gotten a performance review that said we were too emotional? Okay, well, how are my technical skills, right? And who says I'm emotional based on whose subjectivity? So that's the kind of work that we're doing. Now, in terms of acquisition, bringing people on board, Booth 107, all the red shirts, very exciting jobs. We are making offers. But mostly, I am living proof of Raytheon. As I mentioned earlier, I am a woman of color. I work in Tucson, Arizona. I wasn't readily very comfortable joining a company that I thought would not accept me. I'd also been out of the workforce for 9 years. And Raytheon trusted me. They saw in me those transferable skills, right? They saw that I had that capability to quickly get on board, that I brought what they wanted, and they could groom me into being the kind of leader that they wanted. So that's my appeal. That's my spiel.
Great. Fantastic. So thank you both, Cheryl and Lisa. Prove it again, bias, as well as tightrope bias, certainly maybe that might gender a couple of questions that might be out there. We want to certainly make this as interactive and make sure we address your questions as we go along the way. Anybody have a question thus far? Yes.
So Cheryl, correct?
Yes.
I was happy to hear about what's happening next week with the 300 plus African-American leaders in a forum. Can you give us some sense of how did that happen? Where did the support from the leadership occur to make something like that happen? And what are the outcomes of having 300 plus people of color come together?
Yeah, so I have to contain myself and not jump up and down with pom-poms because I get pretty excited when I start to talk about this kind of stuff. So I've been with the company for 15 months, so it started well before me. So this started over 15 years ago, I think, Rania, at least 15 years ago. And it actually was started by a group of African-American employees that said, we need help. We want support. We want to come together. We want a network. We want professional development. And it really is part of a movement. So it's not only the African-American population. They'll be together next week, but we do this for all of our ERG communities on an annual basis. They all have strategies. And so our African-American community has a five-pronged strategy that includes focusing on recruiting on campuses and, you know, making sure that they're getting professional development. It's several different things that they focus on. They are led by a leadership council that is spearheaded by our two most senior African-American leaders in the company. Actually, there are others that are at the same level as those leaders, but two amongst our most highest ranked lead that council. And they are self-empowered to put together the agenda that they want to come and talk about what matters to them. And I think for us, we really all get excited because our CEO shows up at every single one of these forums and has had been doing that for many, many years. And so for us, it's really become ingrained as a part of our retention approach for the company. But we are, as you can tell, quite proud of it.
Yeah. That's very important. And even at the Federal Reserve, I have 14 peer-level, C-level executives that I work with. And I assign each of them an HBCU to go to. All right? And I say, once a year, you have to show up at an HBCU and do recruiting so that they have firsthand experience that then diverse professional organizations. I've tried to assign them each a diverse professional organization to be responsible for as well. So getting executive level commitment is very important. But I will tell you quite honestly is the fact that oftentimes getting executive level commitment is not as hard as one would think. Where it tends to fall apart is mid-level. So all of you that are in mid-level management, all of you have a very, very important responsibility to make sure that you carry that flag forward, all right? So you get a lot of executive commitment at the top, you get a lot of individual contributors that are all supportive, but sometimes it falls apart in the mid-level. So I will tell you, mid-level management is going to be vital to the success of your organization in terms of carrying these strategies forward. We have another question back here from the back.
Yes, I have a follow-up question. Sometimes when we start these initiatives in companies, and we have large groups of any minority come together, we have the predominantly white population say, well, why are they allowed to do that? Mm-hmm. So how have you combated that?
Yeah, and I don't know that I would say that we've combated that, but what we have done is we've created an approach that is, so anybody in the company can be a part of any of these groups. These groups are not, you can only come to ACE if you're black, right? So by policy, anybody can come. But we also have a really strong focus now on encouraging allies. And so we will have allies this year that will actually be part of this forum. We're seeing an increased percentage of allies that are stepping forth and saying, I do want to be a part. I do want to be a supporter. I do want to be an advocate. And so we continue to promote the fact that it's open and it's inclusive for anybody that wants to be involved.
And not to put Janice on the spot, but reflecting back on our matrix model here, anything that you want to offer relative to insights that might be beneficial for everyone in terms of tools and capabilities to take away from this discussion today?
Thank you for asking. In regard to the actual matrix and what has been discussed thus far, it fits directly into it with the idea of objectives. Let's see if I can do this. Looking at the the goals themselves as the key objectives that would go into place there. Thinking about the actual value of the organization, keeping in mind the mission, and as you've mentioned, a lot of the executives having their vision of really going forward and being engaged and a part of this collaboration and the initiative of D&I and the organizations. Thinking of creatively, how does it happen? Cheryl had mentioned about the acknowledgement of the 350 leaders that are identified. And considering the actual connection, looking at allies and mentorship, which was also mentioned, that fits right into this processes of moving forward and advancing in a rapidly changing time. And keep in mind too, technology is quite often a stumbling block, but it's also our friend. So we have to think about how we can utilize that in looking at algorithms, also coming together with 101s and conversations, just to break down some of the actual curation of the data, is to identify and have the empathy with the groups and to understand what their needs are, and to, for it to be impacted at all levels, I think is very, very critical. And it fits directly into the matrix as well, into the tool.
Fantastic. Lisa, anything you want to add at this particular juncture?
Well, particularly to the wealth of the employee resource groups, I'd say that for us, we regard our employee resource groups as ambassadors. They are the ones that actually have that touch point with our 70,000 employees. They're the ones that communicate to us, to our leadership councils. Every business unit has a leadership council on what's really going on the ground. When we think of each of our groups, just the same as Lockheed Martin, everyone is welcome to join any group, but they particularly focus on the needs of that affinity group. This is our only way of knowing how some of our messaging, some of our requirements, some of our policies and procedures are really being felt on the ground. If I didn't have contact with my RABETS group, I'm not a veteran. So I didn't understand sometimes how the way that we deploy performance reviews kind of goes counter to how they're used to getting feedback in the military, and I need to adjust accordingly. The same thing happens with OLA, with our Hispanic group. Different need for connection and communication, RAPA, Raytheon Asia Pacific group. So for us, we really regard them as ambassadors. It's my only way of really knowing how the messaging is being heard, whether some of the decisions that are being made at the senior level are really realistic as they hit the road. And for me, they're my partners, so I couldn't do what I do without them.
You're listening to Leadership and Excellence in Diversity, Sustaining the Diversity Momentum in Changing Times, a professional development seminar featuring Donnie Harper, Lisa Reiser, Cheryl Kern, and Dr. Janice Farah-Samani. Brought to you by the Bay of STEM Global Competitiveness Conference, where we stand at the intersection of America's future. Be sure to check out our social media pages on Facebook and Twitter.
Great. So one of the advantages of having two mics, I get to ask questions too. All right, so, because I really had two burning questions coming into this particular session as well. So let's tackle the second part of the title, Sustaining Momentum in Changing Times, all right? Wacky world we live in today. So back when I was growing up in my generation, post, you know, the tail end of baby boomers, we didn't have all of the social media technology. So things that were happening back 30 years ago are now coming to light, right? So I live in the state of Virginia. You know, there's probably no worse place to live right now than from a social media standpoint, all right? And as you think about it, and even our earlier question about was even kind of drawing into question about, do we really have momentum, right? So I'm going to take a quick survey and ask a quick poll here. How many, a three-part question. How many of you believe that from a diversity and inclusion standpoint, we are far better now than we were 20 years ago? Okay. How many of you believe we're about the same as we were 20 years ago? How many of you believe that we are worse than we were 20 years ago? Okay. So a little bit more on the favorable side. Okay, that's okay. But we're talking about sustaining momentum. So we all got to agree that, number one, do we really truly have momentum in this particular space? We're doing a lot more talking. So certainly a lot of talking that could be kind of construed as momentum. But are we really seeing outcomes and results? So that's number one for the panel to consider. Let's first just kind of do that. Just any thoughts in terms of just the times that we live in today and what we have to deal with, not only at home, but you hear in the media, and then bringing that in those social conversations, and how you have employee resource networks that can sort of help one another, but at the same time, are we really getting to the essence of what the core issues are? And then from there, how does that make for a more inclusive environment in our organization? So thoughts, reactions from the panel?
You know, it's a little bit underscoring what I just said. So I agree with you. Times have changed completely. Communication is live, it's real. Things happen in the moment. They need to be addressed or responded to in the moment, which is really why I underscore the need for it, that having that close relationship with my employee resource groups. It used to be, and I have a background in sociology, you know, we'd see a trend, and then we'd do an employee survey, and then you'd get all these little numbers, and you would do a focus group, another focus group, and you'd write a paper, and you'd present it, and by then the problems just, you know, either went away because they were so exhausted, or, you know, they grew into bigger problems. Now, there's such an immediacy of people responding to things that they're hearing in the news, and not always in a good way. Things happening throughout an organization like ours our footprint is all over the world. If I did not have those open channels of communication, and that means more me listening than me broadcasting, I couldn't respond with the immediacy that I need to respond. So to keep up the momentum, as you said, is to identify what the issues are, where they're bubbling up, and the only way to do that is to have open channels of communication, and that's kind of how I operate.
I think from my standpoint, it's a question of is it that we need to accelerate or that we need to sustain momentum? And I think when you asked the question, as many hands went up that said we're worse off than we previously were, as went up saying that we're okay where we are. And so I really think it's a case that needs to be built around what do we really need to do to accelerate? Because if we continue to just have momentum just a little bit going forward, we're really going to fall backwards. And so, you know, I think to Lisa's point, I would just echo that it's going to take not just one approach, but, you know, a lot of different approaches that are really kind of tailored and customized. And as I had said earlier, kind of this culture of listening is going to be critically important. We just came out of a workshop that we sponsored an hour ago that focused on this very topic about, you know, staying relevant, how am I feeling, can I show up, can I be authentic? And the people around the table were all still saying, I still can't be authentic. And if you think about it, we've been having this conversation for over 20 years now. And so it's a real issue in terms of do we maintain momentum or do we really need to change the game and accelerate some things differently? And so we talked about this strategically, leveraging authenticity for yourself, and we called it SLAY. And I think it serves as a good example of another form of communication that we have to have in place in order to your point, to hear what people are thinking, how they're feeling, and how we need to pivot to give them the support that they need. And the people that were sitting at my table, and then I'll wrap it up here, not all felt comfortable even leaning in and saying that they had these concerns. And so it makes me worry how much talent might we lose if they don't feel comfortable that they can lean in and have these conversations.
Very important, because ultimately a lot of this comes back down to each of us as individuals. And we all have stories, I'm sure. Just driving up here on Tuesday night from Richmond, Virginia, stopped at an Arby's. A white man walked in, 6'5", probably every bit of 400 pounds, had a Confederate bandana tied to his head. And you could just see people in the restaurant beginning not only to give him personal space, they gave him enterprise space. So everybody was moving away from this guy. And so I'm standing there, and it's an opportunity, right? So the guy was complaining. So number one, he didn't get his double cheese roast beef sandwiches. He ordered two of them. He didn't get them early in the day, and he was upset. So the whole situation just didn't feel comfortable. After he kind of got that clarified with the manager, he looked over, and we made eye contact. I was about the only person that made eye contact with him. It was an opportunity. You can use it as an opportunity to try to do something to build a relationship, or I can just sort of look away and not build a relationship. Long story short, spent 23 minutes talking to this guy. Nicest guy in the world you ever want to meet. But I immediately had a bias. When I saw him and that Confederate bandana, I'm thinking, no way in the world I'm gonna talk to this guy. We ended up talking about a whole bunch of stuff, from gravel to you name it. We talked about a whole bunch of things. So I say this, that each of us individually, when we think about it, what's in it for me, and we talk about diversity and inclusion, we talk about working in organizations, large cultures, you know, thousands and thousands of people around the world, stuff like that, and we talk about how we can advance our careers and things of that nature, still think about it from your lens and what filters are we individually using as we look at the world and look at opportunities. Are we overlooking opportunities for ourselves, or do we have biases ourselves that are inhibiting us from really seeing a larger picture? So I would just kind of throw that out there. Any reactions from the panel first, and then we're going to ask more questions of the audience.
I like to speak to that. Okay. If I may. I think it's really critical. I mentioned the word empathy, but that was amongst a lot of other words. Empathy is at the core of really what we're talking about. It gets down to the systemic issue of bias, and it really allows for you to build out the relationships that you've alluded to and that we've talked about as a panel, to connect at all levels and with various people, to really understand and collect that information, but not only collect the information that it sits in a report or becomes a bigger issue, but to actually engage it in such a way that you can make change. And some of those engagements are really, I think, part of the conversation. What does that look like? Are we going to celebrate? Are we going to develop programs that could actually build out initiatives? Are we going to go to HBCUs and assign executives to really understand the culture of the HBCUs and to actually buy in and invest in curating and actually retaining, if you will, Black individuals and people of color in our companies? So I think the idea of empathy is at the core of that. I recently saw a book, it was Against Empathy, which I thought was quite interesting. And it spoke directly about that and having this wall of not so much feeding into your biases, but actually saying that there's not a direct connection. But I completely disagree. I think it's about building out allies, building community, making those connections, curating information, getting that, collecting that information, and then implementing it into an action.
I really like that concept. I love empathy. I mean, empathy breaks down barriers.
Indeed.
It really does. And Donnie, your example, your story is wonderful. It reminds us to be who we need to be as good citizens, right? And being open to meeting people and trying to understand them before we impose labels. From my own perspective, and this is where I wanted to talk just a little bit about bringing your whole self to work. And I feel like that's still a concept that some of us are struggling a little bit with, because what does that really mean? And sometimes we tell people to bring their whole selves to work, and then we go, holy cow, you really did. maybe you should have left a little bit of that. But what does that really mean? And for me and for everyone, it's kind of that passion that you have in your core. It's that thing that makes you happy. It's that thing that makes you sing in the shower. It's that thing that you can do for hours and hours and never feel tired. In my case, it's art. Are there any artists in the room? Oh, okay, we have a few. We walk amongst you. Artists see the world in a very particular way. We always see things as opportunities, okay? So where others may become very pragmatic, especially if you're working in an engineering field where there's these risk assessments and all of that is very valid, you need the data to make the decisions, to artists will always see myriad possibilities. I bring that to work with me. I don't come to work and say, hey, I'm, you know,
working on a pastel at home right now. It's just fabulous. I don't talk about that because no one really wants to kind of hear that. But I bring those skills that have made me successful as an artist, that ability to look at things from different, a myriad of angles, to find a myriad of solutions. And okay, 30% are going to be really out there and maybe not feasible, but usually I'll land on a combination of possibilities that I can then take to teams that we can kind of flush out and turn into new solutions. So I invite all of you as individuals to be thinking about those values, the things that you could bring to work that maybe you're holding back, but also as leaders, for those of you that lead teams, help your people understand who they are. We're not really trained to think about, you know, who we really are and what motivates us. That's not something you really learn in school. We're more taught to be obedient. At home and in church, we're taught to be, to work within a framework. Give them Myers-Briggs assessments, color assessments, do all of those good things. It helps people feel valued. And then as you're mentoring your teams, coach them to use, to look at those natural innate skills that they have and how those translate into marketable skills in the office place. It'll make them happier and they will surprise you with their new way of approaching work. And that's really where we make that bridge from diversity to inclusion. Thank you.
Fantastic.
I just wanted to add one quick thing, Donnie, if I could. And I think I love this whole conversation, starting with, you know, empathy and then talking about including your team. And I think it ultimately ends up with, we want employees to have this sense that they belong. This whole notion of belonging is critically important. And if you don't feel like, no matter how you show up, and I said, I understand you to say, help them understand who they are, give them these different tests, do all of that. That's wonderful. But if you do all of that, they should then on the other end feel like, I really belong because you poured into me, Lisa, as my leader. You helped me to better understand myself, and I feel a part of this family, and I feel that I belong. And so I think this whole kind of fuzzy term of belonging that we all talk about in D&I, I think we really need to bring some more finite structure to it and really build it out using maybe your model to actually have it be something that can be structured in a framework with some ROI, because that sense of belonging and family, especially for Gen Z and the millennial generation, it's really everything to them. They will go somewhere else if they don't feel they belong.
We're great.
Consider the companies. We and the Valley, it's very interesting. During the summer, I've actually had the opportunity of meeting a lot of students that have come from around the country, go to the Valley, right, to work. And it's really exciting for them. But many of them, I would say 98% of them, do not want to return to the company because they're not valued. They're not seen as it's an opportunity of belonging. And no matter how many diversity directors companies have in Silicon Valley, there's still very limited momentum of change. So it's very interesting. It's very timely.
Fantastic. All right. So the three original questions we received at the beginning, I think one was on retention. The other one was, how do you survive if you're the only one? And then how do we sustain momentum and in an organization? I think we've touched on all three of those initial questions. So we've got about 15 minutes left. I'm sure there are many other questions. What else? So who would like to ask a question? Okay, all the way in the back. After I walked all the way up there.
Good morning, good morning. And thank you to the panel for your remarks and your insights. As we are continuing to kind of shift our thinking around diversity and inclusion and understanding the lived external realities of some of our employees, how important is intersectionality to this conversation? As we, you know, are moving from this traditional model of silo way of thinking that you only can be Black, but cannot be Black and woman, how do we continue to bring forth those issues of intersectionality as we continue to address some of our workforce challenges?
Thank you.
Do you want me? Everybody's looking down at this end of the table. Like, I don't have the answer to that one. Cheryl, you have the answer to that one. You know, Damian, and so Damian is on my team, in full confession. Damian is one of the ones that stretches me and helps me to continue to grow while I, as he says to me, iron sharpens iron. I don't think it's a simple answer. I think it's very complex. And I think because we do, to Lisa's point, because we do have these inherent, let's face it, biases that have been instilled in us depending upon where we grew up and how we were raised, then we want people to swipe their badge and come into the company and it's kumbaya and everything goes away. And everything is this beautiful blend of rainbow of intersectionality where we all just kind of get along. And that's just something that's not only not our reality, but that we continue to strive for. I do think to the extent that we are holding up and building across those bridges our ally communities and doing intentional work around making sure that they know that we not only want to invite them in, but that we need them so that we can better understand each other. I think some of the dialogues that we've talked about today, like the workshop that we did, we also did a day of understanding where everybody from all these different groups are all talking about, this is who I am, who are you? This is how I want to show up. This is how I want to be valued and respected. What do you want from me? And so it's the hard work, it's not the easy work that really allows us to kind of leverage intersectionality. And I do know there's a very official answer that I could give to that, but that's the real answer to the question, is that that's the really hard work. And it's not just a pat approach to, if group A does this and group B does that, it's just not that simple. It's the slow but continual kind of process of inviting in all those differences and helping to create the awareness that those differences actually make us all better.
And I would also like to add that diversity, the intersectionality, is bringing the diversity to the table. And truly, that's where companies are finding, they're actually acknowledging that the diverse table makes the company better. It makes the technology better. It makes the innovation, if you will, better. So I think that that is probably some of the added value, is realizing the richness of diversity at the table.
All right, have another question.
Hello, my name is Alicia Charlo. I work at Raytheon Missile Systems in Tucson, Arizona. Graduating from an HBCU, Alabama A&M University, and moving to Tucson, Arizona was a complete cultural shock for myself. And what's very important is to just have that open conversation, as you mentioned, just speaking, saying hello, being relatable. I remember one of my coworkers brought in tamales, and I said, okay, this is great. I had no idea you had to peel back the corn husk. So I'm like, okay, this was really good, but it was a little tough. You know what I mean? But, and that was something that my coworkers would laugh about, but I was willing and open to try new things. And I think that's very important when it comes to employees, not only just keeping that positive attitude, but being relatable, having those conversations, being open to just speaking and saying, okay, well, this is a little different. Can you explain to me, you know, why is this a tamale? What's going on here? You know what I mean? So I think it's very important. And just to piggyback what Lisa had mentioned earlier, it is being relatable and open to having those open, candid conversations that some people are afraid to even talk about. But at least bringing it up, even if it is a little bit uncomfortable, can really make a difference on your day-to-day work. It really can.
You can.
And now I know how to eat a tamale. Yeah.
You can take that open seat up there if you want to. Very good.
I didn't quite hear a question in that, Alisa, but I love everything that you said, and it really ties back also with what Donnie was saying. And basically, it comes into reminding ourselves sometimes to lean in, right? So when we're presented with a new culture that's different, that we're not fully embedded in, have the courage to lean into it and explore a little bit, ask questions, and be ready to make mistakes, because we will make mistakes. We're only human, right? But it's that openness. I don't know for those in the room if you embrace or not the theory of evolution, but the phrase that everyone uses is the survival of the fittest, right? And survival of the fittest doesn't mean the strongest, it means the most adaptable. Right. So those of us that are going to be successful need to be adaptable, right? We need to lean in and kind of adapt a little bit to the new culture and understand it better. So thank you for sharing.
Great. So my job as the moderator is to make sure we end on an upbeat note, right, before we, yeah. Because I want you to all go out of here thinking that was the best, no, you're gonna say this is the best session that you attended in Baylor. But I do wanna ask one question before we end on the upbeat note, and that is failures. not everything is going to work out perfectly. So we talk a lot about all these great success stories and where we made some progress, but I just maybe just ask the panel relative to learning opportunities that may have come from some failures where we may have tried some things. Because in order to make change and progress, you're going to have to try some things. And everything you try, it's not going to work out perfectly, right? So I can think about times in my career where I've tried some things to try to help, let's say, the overall diversity momentum or whatever I might have been doing from a staffing standpoint, just didn't work out how I had envisioned. So I don't know if the panel has any thoughts or insights or reactions to just maybe some things that just didn't work out and some of the takeaways and learnings that you may have gotten from those types of experiences. And then we're going to end on an upbeat note.
Yes, we need to learn from our failures, but we need to not be afraid to fail. Real learning and real growth comes from failure. As embarrassing as it can be, we have to just kind of accept that's part of life. Learning to ride a bike, how much did that hurt? You know, it is putting yourself out there. If you're genuine and respectful and honest and open and trying to connect, people will forgive your failures, right? And they'll give you the feedback and be open to that feedback and learn from it and then move on to the next step. It's like when I conduct focus groups, I've done a lot of those kind of surveys and focus group activities, and I always encourage leaders when they're about to get that, you know, that data that we call your baby's ugly, you know, I get to tell you the stuff that, oh my goodness, embrace that. Embrace the feedback, embrace the negative feedback, embrace the criticism. Don't be afraid of it. Be afraid when people stop talking to you.
Bingo.
Exactly. Right? Exactly. So thank you for asking us that question.
I would just like to add, see value in everything. Your opportunity of having a tamale was a huge value because it broke down barriers. Ask those hard questions, those uncomfortable questions. Taking risk and being uncomfortable, actually you benefit as well as your teams and your organization in the long run.
The only thing that I would add is that when you're in D&I, you sort of get used to failing forward. It's what our role is. We're change agents, and there's so much that we go forth with that we get so many no's to, and we have to go back and innovate and recreate and think of a better mousetrap. And so for us, I think we become kind of skilled in terms of learning how to handle failure and bounce back from it and keep going forward. So
yeah, we're good at failing.
All right, so I'm going to turn it back to Denise for a couple of minutes, then we'll ask a couple of more questions at the end, and then we'll wrap up.
Okay, wonderful. I was just going to add, if I may, this process for individuals as well as teams and organizations, exactly what we've been talking about. And identifying a key strategy is really a focal point. Taking those goals as well as the vision of your leadership, and as middle managers, create your own vision and your own goals for your teams that you'd like to move forward. Taking those objectives that you've identified as a team, don't let them sit in a report, but actually move them into a model of transformation and identifying those actions that you want to move and stimulate, if you will, momentum to make the actual change toward diversity and inclusion. And then lastly, just to identify those key factors and wrapping into the tools as well as your organization values, the integration and perceptions, as well as the systems and foremost, the input from your organization and your teams within your organizations. So this is actually a transformation process that I've utilized, and I've seen many companies that I've had influence to actually work with as a consultant to actually move forward and to stimulate and to catalyze change within their organizations. So lastly, we just have a call to action for you. And that call to action has 6 points. To prepare your initiative with empathy. Be mindful. Be relatable. Allow yourself to take those risks and be uncomfortable, because out of that uncomfortability comes success. Definitely assess the needs. Therefore, you will be interacting with other individuals. You'll be having those one-on-ones. You'll have group conversations. And to take that forward to identify the diversity within your organization. develop those visions, your vision, your goals, as well as your strategic plan. That is your call to action to move forward with momentum. Implement it in such a way that it actually will take immediate change and to wrap into the momentum of the organization in this rapidly changing time. Develop your strategy, utilize the tool. I am happy to share that with you. It is copywritten. So please feel free to utilize the tool. And if you have any further questions, I'm happy to answer those with utilization. Monitor and evaluate your actual process and your progress and share it with others. There's no one size fits all, we know that, but allow yourself to share those ideas and maybe people can take bits and pieces and actually integrate it into their processes. So thank you.
Great. All right, so that completes our schedule portion of the program, and certainly we have an opportunity to ask any additional questions. And while I'm walking to the front with the mic, I'm gonna put in a shameless plug. Stop by booth 525.
Good. From FCA, Fiat Chrysler Automobiles. I am not in human resources. I come from a different perspective. I'm an engineering supervisor, and I work in the plant. So I'm in the factory. Mm-hmm. One thing I've found is they're not very open and receptive to allowing people to leave, to get training like this and to develop themselves. How can we get together and do that and convince our HR, our group to give us that time that we need to develop ourselves?
Right. Good question. Thank you. And the bulk of our teams are working factories or they're engineering teams, and they can't necessarily, they don't have time to disengage from the factory floor and go to training. We embed the training into the organization. So I don't know if you have a kind of training modules, training and development as part of the performance. No. So what I have done, because I've been both an external and an internal consultant, obviously you always have to train to adapt to the needs of the organization. And what I would look for are any opportunities where you already have your teams together, stand-up meetings in the morning, staff meetings, all-hands meetings, and start carving out percentages of that time to train people, to give them what you think they need to be able to grow in the way you want them to grow. And if it's diversity training, do it, right? Do it then. Have these diversity moments. You'd be surprised, even doing it little by little, these small increments, you will start to see change. Just be sure to always be tapping into what you're doing. Do it, as Janice reminded us, with a strategic plan, right? So something that you can kind of document, measure, and then go back and see that I really make a difference here, test the waters, and then just keep going. Hopefully that'll help.
Just to add to what Lisa's saying, it's excellent, is you can do it in design review from an engineering perspective. I've done it as an engineer, and it can be part of the actual process itself, embedded without them ever really realizing it. And then it's measurable, and that can go to HR to actually support the idea of ROI, and that they can actually invest in that process or that initiative. But definitely in design review and development of product.
And in addition to that, I also think that there's just some simple steps that can be taken. Are we making sure that we're setting up our ERGs so that they can be engaged? Do we have a funding model that supports that?
Sure.
You know, are we taking the training to them at point of need? You know, I've worked at a company where it was 6 o'clock in the morning, we were standing out on the manufacturing floor. That's the only time, and all we could get was 20 minutes. And so we did 20 minutes for 1 month straight to get them what everybody else got. So I think it's also kind of flipping it and putting us into their shoes and thinking about what they really need and then bringing it to them.
And I say to any extent that you can do talent mobility, so rotating individuals into your function and letting those others in your function work in other functions to do a swap could be consideration. Okay, other questions? Yes, okay.
Hi, Eileen Tierney from Lockheed Martin. On your flow chart, since this is a continual process of learning and adjustment, the only thing I didn't notice in your flow chart was a feedback loop that you would then take into your strategy again based on your learnings. So you have action,
right,
and then you have, you know, everything that you're focused on. But I could see that you would have, again, learning from your results and then a feedback loop back into your strategy, because it's a continual process of improvement.
Yes. Within the action itself, you have your prototyping. There's several different drop downs from that. You would have the prototyping, which would actually design the activity, whether it be in product development, design review, the huddle on the floor, whatever that would take. That's part of your action, and your iteration would come out of that.
Thank you.
Thank you. Excellent comment.
Other questions? Yes, sir.
Good morning. My name is Paul McKenzie. I'm the...
Stand up.
Better. Good morning. I'm from General Dynamics. I'm a cybersecurity manager. We build a cyber that supports the M182 tank. Anyway, I'm also co-founder of the Dynamic Network of African Americans at General Dynamic Land System, which is our ERG group. And our why is to take advantage of undervalued networks. Mm-hmm. And so our attempt is to try to see what we could do to increase the ROI of our company by having ERGs. I'm very intrigued about what you were talking about, Cheryl, and others about ERGs. And I'm just wondering, we had talked about maintaining, sustaining. I'm looking about accelerating. And I'm asking, what is that next level and the next level where we need to be as ERGs within great companies like yours?
So I'll give a simple answer and then let others weigh in. I think it's about impact, right? So it's been a lot of activity, a lot of good effort, but what are we doing to make an impact? Our ERGs are now starting to shape our policy in really key areas, specifically last year related to some benefits. So when we're seeing that tangible sort of impact on the business, I think that's really where you begin to accelerate it, because their stature is increased. And then they're sought out as consultants to the business.
I love that. Yeah, I completely agree with Cheryl. Impact is the way that you'll get that exposure and that support that you need to then kind of refuel and keep moving forward. But also quick wins for your ERG. Because as people, we're all pretty frustrated. It kind of feels like things aren't moving as fast as they should be moving. We've been talking about this a lot before. So we also need these quick wins. Otherwise, your ERGs will burn out. They get tired of feeling like I'm putting the same Band-Aid on the same boo-boo over and over and over again, right? So definitely high impact, high visibility activities will get the business behind you, but also quick wins for the ERG to keep them motivated and excited.
Fantastic. So we are almost at time, and I'm gonna ask each panelist to give us their final thoughts in 30 seconds, okay? You know it's gonna take 60 seconds, but I'm gonna give it the final thoughts in 30 seconds. So, you know, what is it that's most important that you want this panel or this audience to remember leaving out of this discussion today? So we'll start with Cheryl.
That just wasn't right. So I would say we're all in this together. It takes all of us.
I am going to come back to the bring your whole self to work. I think that's why I am so happy. I actually like going to work in the morning. I love Monday mornings. I invite everyone to have that same kind of excitement. And the only way you'll do it is if you find the way to bring your whole self to work.
Having an entrepreneurial mindset to innovate, take risks, be changeable, be adaptable, as well as be agile.
Wonderful. Let's give our panel a hand. So although they didn't tell me you can do this, but link in with them. So get connected by LinkedIn. I'm sure if you have any residual questions, they'll be available here right at the end. We can gather outside. Also, you can connect with them by LinkedIn as well as myself as well. But thank you for attending. And please be sure to fill out the survey before you leave. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Leadership and Excellence in Diversity, Sustaining the Diversity Momentum in Changing Times, a professional development seminar featuring Senior Vice President of the Federal Reserve Bank of Richmond, Donnie Harper. Manager for Diversity and Inclusion for Missile Systems for Raytheon, Lisa Reiser. Director of Diversity and Inclusion for Lockheed Martin, Cheryl Kern. And CEO of the Ferris Armani Group, Dr. Janice Ferris Armani. If you have enjoyed this presentation, be sure to attend the BEA STEM Global Competitiveness Conference. For more information on how you, your company, or organization can take part, visit www.bea.org. For college students, contact us at 410-244-7101.